is terribly sane and luminous and terribly wanting in self-sacrificial enthusiasm. He questions Plato when Plato would exile poets from his utopia, for poetry is a power. He directs his energy along a line diametrically opposed to Socrates' depreciation of Anaxagoras. He anticipates Bacon and the modern scientific movement in his realization of the importance of ordered knowledge. He set himself to the task of gathering together and setting down knowledge. He was the first natural historian. Other men before him had speculated about the nature of things, but he, with every young man he could win over to the task, set himself to classify and compare things. Plato says, in effect, let's take hold of life and remodel it. This soberer successor, let's first know more of life and, meanwhile, serve the king. It wasn't so much a contradiction as an immense qualification of the master. The peculiar relation of Aristotle to Alexander the Great enabled him to procure means for his work such as were not available again for scientific inquiry for long ages. He could command hundreds of talents. A talent is about £240 for his expenses. At one time, he had at his disposal 1,000 men scattered throughout Asia and Greece, collecting matter for his natural history. They were, of course, very untrained observers, collectors of stories rather than observers, but nothing of the kind had ever been attempted, had even been thought of, so far as we know, before his time. Political as well as natural science began. The students of the Lyceum, under his direction, made an analysis of 158 political constitutions. This was the first gleam of organized science in the world. The early death of Alexander and the breaking up of his empire almost before it had begun put an end to endowments on this scale for 2,000 years. Only in Egypt at the Alexandria Museum did any scientific research continue, and that only for a few generations. Of that we'll presently tell. 50 years after Aristotle's death, the Lyceum had already dwindled to insignificance. Fifth, the general drift of thought in the concluding years of the 4th century BC were not with Aristotle, nor towards the laborious and necessary accumulation of ordered knowledge. It's possible that without his endowments from the king, he would have made but a small figure in intellectual history. Through them he was able to give his splendid intelligence substance and effect. The ordinary man prefers easy ways, so long as they may be followed, and is almost willfully heedless whether they end at last in a cul-de-sac. Finding the stream of events too powerful to control at once, the generality of philosophical teachers drifted in those days from the scheming of model cities and the planning of new ways of living into the elaboration of beautiful and consoling systems of evasion. Perhaps that's putting things coarsely and unjustly, but let Professor Gilbert Murray speak upon this matter. The cynics cared only for virtue and the relation of the soul to God. The world and its learning and its honors were as dross to them. The Stoics and Epicureans, so far apart at first sight, were very similar in their ultimate aim. What they really cared about was ethics, the practical question how a man should order his life. Both, indeed, gave themselves to some science, the Epicureans to physics, the Stoics to logic and rhetoric, but only as a means to an end. The Stoic tried to win men's hearts and convictions by sheer subtlety of abstract argument and dazzling sublimity of thought and expression. The Epicurean was determined to make humanity go its way without cringing to capricious gods and without sacrificing free will. He condensed his gospel into 4 maxims. God is not to be feared, death can't be felt, the good can be won, all that we dread can be borne and conquered. And meanwhile, the stream of events flowed on, with a reciprocal indifference to philosophy. Sixth, if the Greek classics are to be read with any benefit by modern men, they must be read as the work of men like ourselves. Regard must be had to their traditions, their opportunities, and their limitations. There's a disposition to exaggeration in all human admiration. Most of our classical texts are very much mangled, and all were originally the work of human beings in difficulties, living in a time of such darkness and narrowness of outlook as makes our own age, by comparison, a period of dazzling illumination. What we shall lose in reverence by this familiar treatment, we shall gain in sympathy for that group of troubled, uncertain, and very modern minds. The Athenian writers were, indeed, the first of modern men. They were discussing questions that we still discuss. They began to struggle with the great problems that confront us today. Their writings are our dawn. They began an inquiry, and they arrived at no solutions. We can't pretend today that we've arrived at solutions to most of the questions they asked. The mind of the Hebrews, as we've already shown, awoke suddenly to the endless miseries and disorders of life, saw that these miseries and disorders were largely due to the lawless acts of men, and concluded that salvation could come only through subduing ourselves to the service of the one God who rules heaven and earth. The Greek, rising to the same perception, wasn't prepared with the same idea of a patriarchal deity. He lived in a world in which there wasn't God, but the gods. If perhaps he felt that the gods themselves were limited, then he thought of fate behind them, cold and impersonal. So he put his problem in the form of an inquiry as to what was right living, without any definite correlation of the right living man with the will of God. To us, looking at the matter from a standpoint purely historical, the common problem can now be presented in a form that, for the purposes of history, covers both the Hebrew and Greek way of putting it. We've seen our kind rising out of the unconsciousness of animals to a continuing racial self-consciousness, realizing the unhappiness of its wild diversity of aims, realizing the inevitable tragedy of individual self-seeking, and feeling its way blindly towards some linking and subordinating idea to save it from the pains and accidents of mere individuality. The gods, the god-king, the idea of the tribe, the idea of the city, here were ideas that have claimed and held for a time the devotion of men, ideas in which they have a little lost their individual selfishness and escaped to the realization of a more enduring life. Yet as our wars and disasters prove, none of these greater ideas have yet been great enough. The gods have failed to protect. The tribe has proved itself vile and cruel. The city ostracized one's best and truest friends. The god-king made a beast of himself. As we read over the speculative literature of this great period of the Greeks, we realize three barriers set about the Greek mind from which it rarely escaped, but from which we now perhaps are beginning to escape. The first of these limitations was the obsession of the Greek mind by the idea of the city as the ultimate state.